talk about connections and curvature in the main. Before starting, I just want to discuss a little bit more about the Lie derivative and Lie bracket, because there's a couple of properties that we're going to be using when we actually think about deriving the connection using this Cartan formalism. So that's the aim of today's lecture. So just as a reminder, we had the Lie derivative, which we could express in terms of a component, a set of derivatives in component form. And so if you have a Lie derivative of an arbitrary tensor, you basically build it up using the pattern of you first take the partial derivative along V of your object. For every vector index, you subtract derivatives of V, you basically substitute in sum over each vector index with a minus sign, and for every covector index, you sum over, again, derivatives of V, but this time with a plus sign. So we talked about what the covector Lie derivative was. So you sort of spot the pattern and build up a general expression. But for two vectors, you also have the fact that the Lie derivative is expressible as a commutator or the Lie bracket. And so you would define that as VU minus UV acting on functions. So that's how you would see the commutator. So then, try and work as much in the normal order as possible. So I'd like to just illustrate what the significance of this Lie bracket is in terms of a picture or geometry. So it's, if you have your field V and your field U, and you imagine going a little distance T along V and a little distance S along U. So in this case, you first go along V, a little distance s along u, in a curved space, or indeed for a general vector field, this will not be the same as first going along u and then v. And so I'm just simply going to demonstrate that this discrepancy here is proportional to uv. So we'll do this by sticking to a single underlying chart. We're imagining that T and S are much less than 1, so we're going to expand in T and S, and this is obviously just going to be an approximate relation. So if I look at my coordinates at A, how do I get to A? I start at naught. I move this little distance t along v. And then if I go to second order, so my subscripts here are just illustrating that I'm evaluating them at the point x naught. So it's just a Taylor expansion. So those are the coordinates of my point A, and I get them by going along this curve, which is defined by V. So if I now ask what are the coordinates at B, well, they're going to be the coordinates at A plus S U plus a half S squared, the derivative of u along u, evaluated at A. But then I want to write everything as an expression evaluated at x naught. So I start off by writing my xa. Then I look at the second term. This is already first order in my expansion parameter. So I say that u at a is equal to u at naught plus the derivative of u along v at naught. And then I don't need to go any further in my expansion because I'm just keeping all terms to second order. And this final term is already second order. So I can replace u at a by u at zero. So this is my expression for the coordinates at this point B, given the coordinates at O and both u and v and their derivatives at O. So I can get xd by swapping my u and v fields and my s and t parameters, because I'm just doing things in the reverse order. So I simply copy this expression down, but I remember to swap my u's and v's and s's and t's. And so I can see that my expression for xb and xd are actually the same to linear order, in the sense of on this side I've got x naught plus su plus tv, which I've got here x naught plus su plus tv. But at second order, although the t squared and the s squared terms are the same, you can see that there's a cross term, st, which is not the same. So, as promised, the difference between xd and xb is proportional to the commutator. So, what the Lie derivative tells you about is if you have two vector fields, so it tells us how much the lines that are sort of defined by u and v fail to close. So there's another phrase for those lines. They're called integral curves simply because it's a curve given by integrating up a vector field. So that's quite a nice pictorial feature of the Lie bracket. So it sort of tells you that if you've got, for example, if a Lie bracket vanishes, say for two vector fields, then that means that you can uniquely, if you go along one and then the other, it's the same as swapping the order of the vector fields. And what that means is you can define a surface, at least locally, which is uniquely labeled by how far you've gone along one curve and then the other, which tells you that the U and V would define a coordinate system on that surface. So you use these Lie brackets to tell you something about whether or not sets of vector fields can actually form a surface and give you meaningful coordinates on a surface. So I'll probably come back to that property at some point. And I'll probably mention things to do about coordinate systems later on today. So another important thing about the Lie derivative is something called a Killing vector. So if we've got a metric, we can ask if we have any vector fields which leave this metric invariant. So our Lie derivative is, it's telling you something about a rate of change along a vector field. And so what that means is, if you think about it as an example, say, your vector is d by d phi, where we're imagining phi to be some periodic coordinate, it's saying the metric doesn't change along that vector field. So if our phi is a periodic coordinate, we might imagine we've got sort of circles which are labeled by phi, and it's saying the metric doesn't change along those circles. So that would tell us that we had some sort of axial symmetry there. Or an invariant around rotations around some axis. Invariants under rotations around some axis. So it tells us about symmetries of the metric. And so in practice, we use this. If we know we have particular symmetry groups of the metric, we then can say that, you know, a lot of the problems in solving Einstein's equations actually start before you've even started trying to solve them, because the metric has a lot of degrees of freedom. But if it's got symmetries, then you can reduce those degrees of freedom. And so in practice, you end up, you know, you never sit down and work out the consequences of this Killing equation and use it to show how you reduce the number of degrees of freedom in the metric. But it's probably worth doing once at least to actually just see how, when people say the most general spherically symmetric metric is blah, 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 it's probably worth just at least convincing yourself that that is the case by looking at the Killing equations for Killing vectors which satisfy an SO3 algebra. So, you know, I'm just, this is what the why Killing vectors are important and how they can help us in practice. So one final, before moving on, I just want to note a relation between D and the Lie derivative, which we will need in a few minutes. So this is simply saying that the exterior derivative, if you take the exterior derivative of one form and contract it with two vectors, then that's equivalent to taking a sort of commutator of the first vector acting on the scalar function omega v, minus the second vector acting on the scalar function of omega of the first vector, minus this commutator term. Okay, so that's really what all I wanted to say about the Lie derivative. This afternoon, I gather you're going to be, is that right, practicing the Lie derivative and the exterior derivative. So that's going to be what the tutorial's about this afternoon. And so that hopefully will sort of make things sort of more familiar and make more sense. But now I'd like to move on to talking about connections, which of course you've already met. And so I just want to do the connection again from this slightly more geometrical perspective and talk about a way of computing connections which just involves taking exterior derivatives. So we talked about taking derivatives on a manifold, the fact that the derivative ought to have a direction as well as a magnitude. And so we thought about what the gradient was in sort of standard three-dimensional vector calculus and showed if we just naively tried to transport that across, it didn't work. And the reason was obvious once we started to pick apart the definition of a derivative. The fact was if we move in the manifold, as we have to look for a rate of change, then we move to different tangent spaces. And the only way it doesn't matter is if we're acting on a function. So the connection provides a way of linking tangent spaces together. So we define our connection components. By their action on a basis of vectors. So it's sort of reasonably obvious why this is the way they're defined. If we're linking tangent spaces together, we know each tangent space has a basis. Our basis is EA or EB in this case. And therefore, if I want to know how my tangent spaces link together, then I need to know if I start off with a basis at P and I move to a neighboring point, what's the transformation relating my old basis to the new basis at the new point? And so this is simply encoding that. It's saying, you know, if I move to a new point, my EB has to be expressible in terms of the basis at that point, and also my derivative has a, you know, in the sense that the derivative has a direction, but it's a covariant direction, so I should have the covector there. We could also say we could just also write it by essentially, you know, mapping out these particular vector and covector elements there. So the only thing to note, just emphasize, because although in general relativity it doesn't matter, for a general connection it is relevant, this first index on the gamma is always referring to the differentiating index. So this is a covariant object. There's the omega, the basis of covectors on the right-hand side. Its corresponding label is C, which is the first index appearing here. So this one, this first one here, you see the B, the B. So this one is the differentiating index. So just, you know what that means. So once again, we, you know, can derive it simply by a list of of axioms. It's a derivation. It has to commute with contractions. Got to be Leibnizian, so that's the derivation bit. And it reduces to D when it acts on a function. So any derivative always reduces to D when it's acting on functions. So these are really the key features that grad satisfies. But from our perspective, what we need to know is grad is basically partial derivatives plus extra terms that take care of the fact that your tangent spaces link together, potentially in a non-trivial way. So let's have a look at how this relates to our usual familiar expression for a covariant derivative. So let's say we've got a general vector V, and we want to look at what grad V is. This is going to be grad of the components. So it's grad of V as expressed in a particular basis of the tangent space. And therefore, if I look over here, look at my property, commutes. So this should be equal to grad VA times EA plus VA grad EA. So that's the Leibnizian property. It reduces to D on functions. Well, the VAs are just functions, so that's D of VA EA plus VA. And then I wrote down what the derivative of a basis vector was. So I get that. And then I can, by simply relabeling my indices, I see that I can pull out the E in each expression. Here's my covector basis, and I can express dA in terms of the covector basis as partial derivatives. So here, what's in brackets is the familiar expression for a covariant derivative. So if you were doing abstract index notation, you would say that this would be your expression for grad B VA in abstract index notation. But strictly speaking, these VAs are scalars, so grad acting on VA is just DVA. So I'm just trying to sort of highlight here the features of this abstract index notation, which we tend to use most of the time. Just takes a little bit of getting used to. So what connection do we use in general relativity? Well, we use a metric connection. And we use something which is torsion-free, and I'll just explain that, elaborate more on that in a moment. So what this means, torsion-free metric connection, well, the first bit means that grad G equals zero, so the connection, the covariant derivative of our metric vanishes. And then torsion is defined, it's very nearly the anti-symmetric part of the connection. So torsion is defined by taking a sort of a commutator of the covariant derivatives of V and U. So you take the covariant derivative of V along U and U along V, and then you have to just subtract off the Lie bracket. And so you're taking the geometrically invariant anti-symmetric part of the connection there. So torsion is a tensor. Yeah, so here we're thinking of the covariant derivative introduces a covector. Covector aspect to trying to think, I wouldn't say index, but that sort of keeps going back to 19th century notation. So it's essentially you take grad of V, this is now a mixed tensor, rank 1, 1, so therefore you act on the vector U with the covariant part. You're not actually taking its derivative. We would write sort of U dot grad. I also wrote that before. You're basically saying that you're mapping, you're mopping up that covector index using the vector U, or you're mapping down, you're mapping the vector U to a number using the covariant part of that tensor grad V. It's really obvious when you write it in indices, because you would simply write UA grad A. So that's, whichever way you want to think about it, that's what it is. So you can verify that T is actually a tensor, and that is essentially because the difference of connections, of any two connections, is a tensor. You can also see that another reason why it's a tensor is because the way I've written it down, I've not introduced anything which is dependent on a basis. Every term in this expression is geometric. It's a Lie bracket, and here, so at the moment it looks like it's dependent on UV, but these terms here are all geometric. So it's very nearly the anti-symmetric part of the connection, very nearly. What it is, if you write it in components, right? So when you write it in components, you get the anti-symmetric part of the connection minus just an extra little correction term. And the extra little correction term allows for the fact that if you look at your expression for the torsion, which has not just covariant derivatives but also the Lie bracket, you could imagine that you're dealing with vector fields that don't commute. Yep. Yes, so here, just as a reminder, E is your basis for the tangent space. Omega is the basis for the cotangent space. So in supergravity literature, they often use E for both. But I've used a different label, I think mainly to emphasize which space we're dealing with at any particular time. And also, I guess, because, you know, now that I've given them a different label, I could at least theoretically think about moving indices up and down in that, you know, in the label space. But no, I won't do that. So these C's are called the structure constants. Of the basis, EA. Mm-hmm.
So a couple lectures ago, when we motivated the exterior derivative, we noted that when we naively tried to take the derivative of a vector, the error term was symmetric. Mm-hmm. So why, in that case, did we have no torsion if this is the anti-symmetric part of the connection?
Right. So I'm just trying to sort of say. So you're asking why do we have torsion?
I guess naively it would seem like that that analysis showed that the connection was always symmetric.
No, what it showed was in that particular case, the amount by which partial derivatives failed to give you something covariant was symmetric, or at least was symmetric in some pair of indices. So sorry, it's just I'm trying to split that off from the notion of torsion. But that does not mean that when you define a connection, when you try and, you know, in terms of actually linking the tangent spaces together, that covariant derivative does not have to have the gammas being symmetric. What it does mean, though, is that, so when you do a coordinate transformation, your gammas do not transform tensorially. They transform by something which looks like a tensor plus something which, again, is symmetric. So if you like, you could think of the gamma. I hope this is not too inaccurate. You could think of the gamma as having something which is inherent to the covariant derivative in the connection and as sort of a piece which is symmetric. You do the coordinate transformation, you change the symmetric part of gamma. So then this is the reason for difference of connections being a tensor, because if you subtract two connections, you do a coordinate transformation, one transforms tensorially plus something symmetric, the other transforms tensorially plus something symmetric, the two symmetric bits cancel. So there's more to the connection than just the symmetric bit, but, you know, it's kind of hidden in there, if you like. And so it is, you can take a metric connection, but unless you state torsion is zero, you could have a torsion field. So something that people look at when they're trying to extend gravity is adding in a torsion, because that's like an extra degree of freedom. You're adding in something else, some other tensor field. So it is distinct. So if you put in these assumptions that grad G is zero, that the torsion is zero, and I'm just going to note that the structure constants are zero for a coordinate basis. Then you can derive the familiar expression for the Levi-Civita connection. So by using these properties that grad G is vanishes and no torsion, which in the case of a coordinate basis really does mean the connection is symmetric, then you get the familiar GR standard Levi-Civita connection in terms of your metric and derivatives of the metric. So now let's look at a different way of expressing the connection.
There's a minus sign.
Yeah, it's neither minus nor plus, is there? There you go. Yeah, thanks. So if I take my connection components and I mop up the differentiating index here, so this would be saying that if I took grad of E, I would be getting theta so I'm just rewriting the expression that I put down earlier. Then this is a covector or a one form. And it satisfies so it satisfies the property that if I take D of G, then I get the symmetric part of this. So the connection one form has these two labels, A and B. So you could think of that as being some sort of matrix, and that matrix is anti-symmetric if we're in a base. I've said an orthonormal basis there, but basically it's any basis in which the metric components themselves are constant. It doesn't have to be unit. So let's just check this. So D of GAB, GAB are the components. Of the metric in the basis EA, which means that we take two basis vectors, EA and EB, and we act on them, we contract them, if you like, using the metric G. So this I then write as grad G EAB, because D is the, grad is the same as D, acting on functions. And remember the GAB, it's not a tensor, the GAB are the components of G in the basis EA. I now use the fact that this grad commutes with contractions and also the fact that I have my metric connection. I get this. Then the covariant derivative of each basis vector is given in terms of the connection one forms. So that is G C B theta C A plus G A C theta C B, which is theta B A plus theta A B. Yes, yep. So the metric connection, so grad is acting on each of those. You've got three geometric objects here. You've got G, EA, and EB. And you take grad on each of them in turn. So now I want to just look at, I want to see if I can get some expression, some useful way of actually deriving these connection one forms. So I'm just going to do a little bit of rearrangement of this wedge product of my connection one form with a basis vector. So if you remember my connection one form, is simply take the connection components and mop up the differentiating index. Now I look at this expression and I see that omega B cross omega C is anti-symmetric in B and C. So I can write this. As the difference between gamma ABC and gamma ACB. But then I look at my expression for torsion and I say that the difference between, or the anti-symmetric part of my connection is equal to torsion plus the structure constants. So the first part is something geometric. It's the torsion. So I could define my I could define the first piece to be a torsion tensor. Well, a torsion two form actually in that case. And then the second bit, well, what is CABC? Well, the structure constants come from the commutator of the basis vectors, so I just write down what that is, the commutator, and then I've mopped up the vector part of it by contracting with the covector. But then I look at that, and I look at this expression here as a relation between D and L, and that term looks like the last part on the right-hand side. So if I just pick that apart for a minute. So from that, I can see that this should be equal to minus d omega, contracted with EB and EC, minus EB acting on omega A EC, plus EC acting on omega A EB. So I've just used that identity, that relation between D and the Lie derivative. But these two terms here vanish because given that omega is the basis, covector basis dual to the vector basis EB, those just give me Kronecker deltas, which are either 1 or 0, but most certainly constant. So the action of a vector on them just gives me 0. So if I pull all that together, that should have had an A on it here. Just realize. And then I unravel that second expression. I see that this is what I get. And this is Cartan's first structural equation. So what it's telling us is that if I've got my basis of one forms, the omegas, I can find my connection by taking an exterior derivative. So I need to know the torsion, so it's important to know whether or not we've got torsion. As far as we're concerned, we don't, so T is just zero. So all I need to do is I take the exterior derivative of my basis of one forms. If I choose an orthonormal basis, I know that my connection one forms are anti-symmetric, and that's all I need to know. I can compute the connection simply by taking an exterior derivative. Now, at the moment, it doesn't necessarily appear to be that much more straightforward than using the expression for the Levi-Civita connection on the middle at the top. However, when you see this formalism being used in practice, you'll see that actually exterior differentiation is rather quick and somewhat easier than panning through a whole set of indices. And of course, as you go up in dimension, the gain is even better. So to just wrap up, I want to just say a few words about curvature. And I'll state the second structural equation rather than actually deriving it. So we define the curvature of a connection essentially as a commutator of derivatives. So this is directly analogous to gauge theory, where we take a commutator of gauge covariant derivatives to get the curvature, in that case, the curvature of a gauge connection, or our physical field strength, like the Maxwell tensor. So the only thing that's a slight, it's not the precise commutator, because of course, unsurprisingly, there are terms which depend on the Lie bracket. So you have to So you take, you define your Riemann curvature as a map from three copies of the tangent space, TP of M cross TP of M cross TP of M into TP of M. And you do it by taking a commutator of covariant derivatives and then just subtracting off this Lie bracket part, which kind of takes into account any sort of inherent anti-symmetry that's already in there because U and V don't commute. So in components, so it's very nearly the familiar expression when you do it for the Levi-Civita connection. The only extra little piece is that last term, which is just saying if you're in a non-coordinate basis, if you're in a slightly awkward basis, and quite often we are actually, because we may want to use an orthonormal basis, then your components of Riemann curvature have to take into account the fact that your basis has this non-trivial behavior. So those are the components. And the Cartan's second equation is a way of expressing this Riemann curvature using, again, exterior derivatives and these connection one forms. So we first of all define a curvature two form. By mopping up those anti-symmetric final pair of indices. And then our curvature is given as the exterior derivative of the connection one form plus a sort of wedge product of these connection one forms. So in fact, if you look at what I'd just like to sort of just get you to think about as a comparison, if I'm looking at a sort of standard gauge field in normal gauge theory, and I want to find what my field strength is, I take this commutator of derivatives, but then I get so I get the same expression. But you can see that this looks like dA plus, or in this case minus, the commutator of A, or that's like a sort of anti-symmetric product. It's A, that's an anti-symmetric multiplication of those two gauge fields. And I'm just sort of saying, I'm just trying to sort of say, structurally, you can see a sort of quite a similar thing cropping up here with this second equation. So when we're doing gravity or we're thinking about sort of solving problems, we do often use terms that really come from gauge theories. We talk about coordinate transformations as gauge transformations. And so, you know, we tend to sort of say, if we're talking about trying to find a particular gravitating solution, well, what gauge choice are we making in terms of which particular coordinates are we choosing? So this analogy, sort of, you know, you can push it quite away. So just to wrap up, I'll just remind you that physically, so here we've been doing a lot of formalism. We've talked about I've even tried to avoid abstract index notation in the main, and if I've written things with indices in the main here, they've actually represented components. So those B's and A's, say, in this expression over here, are absolutely not meant to represent a tensor. They really are just labels. So they're labeling the connection, the particular connection, one form. But we have to remember that really what we're trying to do is we're trying to describe gravitational systems. So we need to know what physically is going on. And curvature is the physics of our gravitational field. And it tells us about tidal forces. So if we have... So I'm just going to quickly remind you of the geodesic deviation equation. Suppose we have a vector field T, which is geodesic. Which means we have a set of observers. So T defines for us a set of curves, sort of which are parallel, parallelly propagated, autoparallels, whatever. And so our observer follows these integral curves of T, and we can ask what happens to nearby observers. And so I'm going to define, so I choose some initial surface, T equals zero, say, that links together these geodesics, and I label my geodesics by a parameter S, and then I simply say I go a little distance T along my geodesic, and this is still labeled by the same S. So this geodesic is S equals 0, and S equals S1, etc., S equals S2. So what I'm doing is I'm setting up locally a little coordinate system. So by construction, the Lie bracket of T and N vanishes because the Lie bracket tells you how much things a loop does not close. If you go a little distance along one vector plus, you know, a little distance along the other, or the reverse process, if there's a discrepancy, that tells you that's the Lie bracket. So then if I look at what my Riemann curvature gives me, there's no Lie bracket term, so it literally is a commutator of derivatives. The first term vanishes because it's a geodesic. And then the second term, I can swap, say that grad n of t is grad t of n using the Lie derivative vanishing. And so I get an expression for the acceleration of neighboring geodesics. So how does n increase as I move along my T geodesic? Well, it accelerates if the Riemann curvature sort of across the, within that surface is non-zero. So this is telling me about tidal forces. And of course, if I identify T with some sort of time, then I would simply get that ni double dot plus ri zero j zero and j would be zero. So that would be, that's a sort of Newtonian type of expression or limit of this equation. So this is your sort of standard tidal forces. It's saying the things move together or apart if there's curvature there. So tomorrow we'll look at applying this formalism to actually solving some spacetimes, you know, for particular types of physical spacetime, or less physical ones.